This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell. And coming up on the show, Samoa has reopened its borders and families that have been separated for years are finally about to be reunited.
Missing our family back home, especially myself, because I have my eldest son back home and my mom. I haven't seen in over 2 years. So it's excellent news and exciting news.
And as high-level delegates from around the world travel to Solomon Islands to mark the 80th anniversary of the World War II Battle of Guadalcanal, local tour guides are calling for more support to commemorate the battlefields.
We realize that people are coming here, they still said, where's the battlefields? And these sites were identified, but there's no monument.
That story coming up in 5 minutes. First, though, a group of Pacific farm workers in Australia who breached their visa conditions are fighting to get them back, although advocates say it should have never reached this point. It's led to calls for stronger protection for overseas labour, as Callie Buchanan reports.
The red volcanic soil of Queensland's Bundaberg region grows just about anything in a climate similar to Hawaii's. It's well known for its horticulture and is home to most of Australia's macadamia and sweet potato crops. The 24 workers employed under the Pacific Australian Labour Mobility Scheme came to the region for work, but according to solicitor Dana Levitt, they struggled to make ends meet.
These workers were faced with overheads that they couldn't meet because they weren't getting sufficient work. They were employed with an approved employer who is also their sponsor under the scheme. Unable to make ends meet, these workers were very open and vulnerable to inducement from other employers who were not approved employers in the scheme. Because of the circumstance that these workers found themselves in and the promise of getting more work and better pay and being able to meet, you know, their financial obligations, these workers went with that non-approved employer, fell foul of the program and their visa conditions, and have been trying to navigate their way back into the PALM scheme ever since.
The PALM scheme is a program that fills gaps in rural and regional Australia's workforce, but also sends skills and income home to 9 Pacific Island countries and Timor-Leste. Approved employers must ensure the workers are well supported by providing sufficient hours of work, a minimum standard of accommodation, and the same workplace rights as Australian workers receive. But under the visa conditions, the workers have to stay with their sponsor or another approved in the scheme and cannot change jobs unless approved by the federal government. Ms. Levitt says that makes them vulnerable when things don't work out.
I think that there needs to be, and this is not my idea, this is something that has been suggested in one of the many reports that's been commissioned on this subject, an independent body that workers can approach when they have issues related to their inability to make ends meet or their desire to move to another approved employer, because there's no distinction between the people that are going to deport you and the people that are going to help you. They're the same people.
The Department of Employment and Workplace Relations is now assisting those workers who remain eligible to reinstate their visas, a matter a spokesman said they take very seriously. Meanwhile, the company that employed the workers has denied it enticed them to leave the scheme. Company director Izagani Ursua says he's baffled by the accusations.
No, there was no enticing, there was no recruitment. I didn't visit Western Australia, Tasmania or South Australia, wherever they responded from, have meetings and go, you know, this is, I've got a problem. No, that's totally false. And it really hurts as well that things thrown around like that. So it's just accumulated from that, he say, she say. But there's no me enticing them whatsoever. It's just really thrown me out. It's just really a sick feeling in my gut.
Mr. Ursua says his company is now being investigated by the State Labour Hire Authority and he's provided all the information they've requested. It comes as the National Conference of the Australian Workers Union passed a resolution calling on the federal government to crack down on what it called widespread exploitation and rorting of foreign fruit pickers by introducing new laws to limit pay deductions. Some of the Pacific Islanders are still with Mr. Ursua's company and he's backed calls to let them move around if they're unhappy with paying conditions.
Absolutely great workers. Can't fault them at all. They love working. I had a meeting with them last week. Yeah, they're all telling me they enjoy working for us because, you know, you're doing all the right things. You're paying all our entitlements, super tax, everything gets paid. as opposed to whatever's happening in the background wherever they used to work. I think you shouldn't be tied to any employer, I believe, because at some point in time where an employee is not comfortable with their working conditions or their hours, they should have the freedom to move about. But if they're tied to a specific scheme, then that makes it all harder.
It highlights the complexity of accessing overseas labour, an issue the agriculture sector doesn't expect will go away soon. Bundaberg Fruit and Vegetable Growers Chief Executive Bree Grimer says it's something the government and the industry have to get right.
We've traditionally always been so heavily reliant on our working holiday makers, and we know that when the borders closed, we lost so many of those workers. And a lot of funds were put into improving the PALM scheme, the seasonal worker program, and we've had great uptake around that. So we've had some brilliant numbers come into Queensland and into regional areas as a whole, a lot more than we've had before. And if it wasn't for them, we simply would not have been harvesting our crops or planting our crops either.
She supports the idea of an independent and confidential advice service for workers, but she says there's already a lot of support and protection built into the PALM scheme.
There's a lot of work and time and effort that goes into becoming an approved employer, and there should be. We need to make sure that these approved employers are doing everything that's required to look after these workers. It is so incredibly important, because what we've actually found is a lot of these workers, they are highly skilled. And, you know, not only that, but they're putting a lot into the community as well. And we need to make sure that we're looking after them in every aspect so that they can stay here for as long as possible.
In the meantime, the spokesman from the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations says officials will be in contact with each of the affected workers individually this week in an effort to re-engage them in the PALM scheme if their agreements and their visa statuses allow.
That report from Callie Buchanan with additional reporting from Johanna Marie. Now, this weekend will mark the major anniversary of one of the Pacific's most famous World War II battles. High-level delegates from the US, Australia and Japan will travel to the Solomon Islands to commemorate 80 years since the Battle of Guadalcanal. It's hoped the event will kickstart tourism in the country, which has just reopened from the pandemic. But experts say new infrastructure is badly needed, with many famous battlefield sites still unmarked. Carl Evans has the report.
Many decades on from the Battle of Guadalcanal, the cries of anguish on the island haven't stopped. Francis Deve hears them often. He lives on the island, and for 36 years he's helped excavate remains from the battlefields so they can be repatriated to Japan for burial. He also acts as a guide for Japanese visitors who make the pilgrimage to the Solomons to find their ancestors.
It is a deep, deep heart of condolences. Even during our ceremonies, they shout their grandfathers. They call for them. We are here. We bring you food. We bring you water. We bring ourselves. And they write letters. They give homage. They laid wreaths. And they express them that since you left us, we wait for you and you didn't come back. So now I come on behalf of my grandmother, I am your son, and they introduce themselves like that. If you translate those messages where they were telling during during the ceremony, it is very, very tearful, and it's very, very sad in a sense that, you know, you're missing somebody you love, you know?
This week marks the 80th anniversary of the battle, which began on August 7th, 1942. Up until then, the Japanese army had marched relentlessly through the Pacific en route to Australia. But World War II historian and battlefield tour guide Matt McLaughlin says the canal is where everything changed.
It was a pretty crucial battle in the Pacific War. It was the first one that the Americans fought in, and it turned out to be their longest. So it was really the turning point in the Pacific, because up until this point, the Japanese had been advancing pretty much unchecked through Asia and the Pacific. But when they got to Guadalcanal, they met the Americans and were defeated in that battle eventually. And so that was the furthest the Japanese managed to advance in the Pacific. And every step they took from that point onwards was backwards towards Tokyo, where obviously the war ended in 1945. So a very significant battle.
A small airfield being built by the Japanese was the major prize of the battle. It had huge strategic importance and would have allowed the Japanese to cut off Australia from its allies while denying the United States military an important base in the Pacific.
It was a really fascinating Pacific battle because the Americans landed in August 1942 and managed to capture the airfield that the Japanese were constructing and flew aircraft in to operate from that airfield. So the aircraft could only operate during daylight hours. So during the day, America completely dominated the skies. But at night, the Japanese Navy would come in and could operate pretty well unhindered because they didn't have to worry about aircraft. So control of the island really seesawed between the Americans and the Japanese every 12 hours, depending on whether it was daylight or dark. So the Americans were on the island after their initial landing, and for the rest of the campaign, the Japanese continuously sent down reinforcements to try and build up forces to retake the airfield. And that led to several huge battles on the island. But ultimately, the Japanese were never successful in retaking the airfield.
The battle raged on for 6 months, and more than 20,000 servicemen lost their lives. By the time it was over, the tide of war in the Pacific had turned.
In the words of the Japanese, this was the decisive battle that would determine the rest of the war. And that was a pretty fair estimation. I think the Japanese were obviously never going to win against the Americans. But it was important that we kept defeating them on land, that we restricted the Japanese from expanding, that we gave them a bloody nose wherever we could. And Guadalcanal was the first time that occurred. And I think significantly for Australians, we tend to think of New Guinea as the battle that saved Australia. And while New Guinea was extremely important, the decisive battle that meant that the Japanese were forced to pull back and could no longer advance on New Guinea and on Australian ports was Guadalcanal. So the two battles were fought hand in hand. And as Australians, we often overlook Guadalcanal. But I think looking at the history, you'd probably say that Guadalcanal was the more significant of the two.
To this day, relics from the Guadalcanal conflict still litter the ground. 300 sunken planes and ships lie in waters off Honiara, aptly known now as Iron Bottom Sound. For those who know the terrain, evidence of the fighting on land is not hard to find. But Francis Deve says more needs to be done to guide battlefield tourists in the right direction.
This is the biggest project that I'm talking about now. And I wish if Australia, New Zealand or US and or Japan can be willing to step in, and even British, because I need Coast Watch's monuments to be built. I need a Japanese site to be built. I need Australian sites to be built. I need New Zealand sites to be built, monuments, in the parts where the Solomon Islands war covers, you know. We have Australia and New Zealand having a lot of engagement here on Guadalcanal. I've been covering all these sites with my research team. And then we do a lot of information that we collect from them. And it's quite hard to identify sites at the moment. So I'm talking to the Ministry of Tourism, Culture and Tourism. We might be knocking at your doors to make sure that these monuments are built. And it will be an attraction because we realize that people are coming here. They still said, where is the battlefields? And these sites were identified, but there is no monument.
This weekend, the island will welcome more than 200 tourists to mark the battle's anniversary, including a delegation led by United States Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and the new US Ambassador to Australia, Caroline Kennedy. Head of Sales and Marketing at Tourism Solomons, Fiona Tiama, says the event will give fresh impetus to the industry as it seeks to recover from the impact of the pandemic.
We see that tourism holds the future for this country as opposed to the extractive industries. However, there are still some challenges that we really need to work together on from the government level in terms of our infrastructure. As you know, the tourism industry in Solomon Islands are of a very small scale, eco-family-friendly oriented base. We don't have five-star hotels or resorts. We want to keep it at that level, but there still needs to be improvement in terms of infrastructure and more development with our air access and all that sort of things that will support the industry.
Part of the event will be the official announcement of a US ambassador to the Solomon Islands to head up a new American embassy. It's hoped the embassy's presence in Honiara will assist in establishing a dialogue to deliver better tourism infrastructure.
North America and Japan are long-haul markets. So basically most of the visitors that are travelling in from our source markets are mainly diving in World War II. So having that US embassy established in the capital will strengthen strengthen that link, and we hope to see more visitors.
That was sales and marketing boss at Tourism Solomons, Fiona Tierma, ending that report from Carl Evans. And Carl Evans joins me live in the studio to bring you all the latest updates and news headlines from around the region. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Jordan.
And out from Solomon Islands, where you were reporting just there before, let's head over to Papua New Guinea, where authorities are making progress, apparently, in the hunt for the candidates who are responsible for that alleged election violence that was going on in recent weeks. What else do we know?
Yeah, that's right. So police claim they're closing in on 15 candidates in Enga province, who allegedly threatened civilians in an attempt to derail the election. So this was reported by the Post Courier, and they reported that Police Commissioner David Manning actually has the names of the candidates and knows where they're hiding. So this, like you said, follows a really concerning incident a couple of weeks ago, which we reported on, when violence actually got so bad that Manning threatened to recommend a failed election in the province if it continued.
Yeah, it was some pretty scary footage coming out of Papua New Guinea there. People with machetes running around, a lot of people feeling very unsafe, unsafe to even go and vote as well. So it'll be interesting to see sort of what happens if they do manage to find the people responsible for this. What was happening to civilians during that time, during that violence?
Well, it's alleged the groups of the 15 candidates actually instigated a number of attacks, so arson attacks, gunfights, attacks on police vehicles. And what's more concerning is Manning actually said most of them were highly educated individuals, and that actually confused them as to why they were behaving the way they did. Meanwhile, this is reported this morning as well, voting in the National Capital District has been stalled again after scrutineers boycotted the process. And this comes with just 24 hours to go before the return of writ. So time running out over there.
That's right, yes. The return of the writs meant to be finishing, wrapping up tomorrow, August the 5th. So we'll keep across that, of course, here on ABC Radio Australia and Pacific Beat. We do have our afternoon show at 3 p.m. at PNG time, where you'll get the latest updates on what's happening there in Papua New Guinea. Let's head over now to New Caledonia, where there's been wild weather. Seems like perhaps there's been wild weather just around the whole region. We've had wild weather here in Melbourne as well. But some terrible outcomes in New Caledonia, though. Farmers having their crops decimated. How badly have they been impacted?
Yeah, usually farmers cop the brunt of wild weather, unfortunately. And farmers in New Caledonia are pleading for government support after heavy rain wrecked a number of potato, pumpkin and corn crops. This was reported by RNZ New Zealand, and they've spoken to the New Caledonian Agriculture Federation, who say 30% of corn crops in the southern district of Lefoa have been lost. Some farmers have even lost everything, with 40 millimetres of rain falling in one day. One very poor farmer has now actually lost 4 hectares over 3 years due to flooding.
That's horrible. That's a terrible loss there. What are the farmers asking for from the government?
Yeah, so the representative body has sent a letter to the government demanding new reforms and further help. I understand there is current payment reliefs in place for farmers. However, that's only for farmers who've been specifically affected or who are severely affected. So I don't think it's sort of a blanket payment system. So basically, they just need more help and they need more people to qualify for it.
Yeah, that's terrible. Well, we'll see what happens there, and perhaps the government might listen to the farmers.
Rain is not always good for farmers, apparently.
No, exactly, and there's nothing you can do about it either. You're just susceptible to whatever happens with the weather. To some happier news now, though, coming out of the Commonwealth Games, a Nauru weightlifter has dedicated their medal to an ex-champion.
Yeah, that's right. So weightlifter Maximina Uepa has dedicated her Commonwealth Games medal to Rihanna Solomon. So she won the bronze medal in the women's 76 weight category yesterday, and she's used that bronze medal to pay tribute to Rihanna Solomon, who succumbed to COVID in July, very tragically. She was a mother of five and remains Nauru's only COVID-related death so far. So anyway, yeah, really nice story there, and it capped off a really good day for Pacific weightlifting with Samoa's Don Opilodge claiming gold in the men's 96 kilo category.
Yeah, that's beautiful, very touching, and I feel like there's been a lot of those heartwarming stories coming out of the Commonwealth Games. Like you say, that Samoa's weightlifter named his baby Birmingham because he won a medal and he wanted to commemorate the fact that he'd done so in Birmingham. So the Pacific scooping up a lot of medals there in the Commonwealth Games, which is great to see. Carl Evans, thank you so much for bringing us those updates.
Thank you, Jordan.
Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat on this Thursday morning. And back in 2017, a historic meeting of First Nations people in Australia resulted in a call for there to be an Indigenous voice to Parliament. This voice would be a permanent body representing First Nations people that would advise the government on Indigenous policy. And just recently at the Garma Festival, Australia's Prime Minister revealed a proposed set of words to be added to the Constitution for that Indigenous voice to Parliament and has outlined what Australians might be asked in a referendum on the issue. That question, as it stands at the moment, would be, do you support an alteration to the Constitution that establishes an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice? Now, joining me this morning to chat about these developments and the dialogue and discussion is Imelda Davis, who is Chair of Australian South Sea Islanders Port Jackson. Good morning, Imelda.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you for joining the show this morning. What was your first reaction to hearing, I guess, the steps that Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese had taken at the Garma Festival?
Look, I think it's way overdue and we really need to get on with the business. So, of course, since the new government have come in to power and, you know, they're welcomed with open arms because this is one of the most refreshing news for all people of Australia, but in particular First Nations and those families that belong to that community. So, yeah, we have hope, you know, but we need, you know, enshrined voice to Parliament. That's something that's critical now.
Do you think it's the right direction in terms of there being a referendum to have all of Australia voice its opinion on it towards getting more political power for Indigenous voices here in Australia?
I think it's really important that, you know, to the wording that's being used, you know, about we're here to take everyone along with us. So it's a very inclusive approach. It's a decision for the nation because obviously this space is shared. Yes, it's unceded lands, but at the same time, 200 plus years of colonisation, 60,000 plus years of, you know, occupancy by First Nations Aboriginal leaders, and being able to sit down and have that conversation, you know, that makarata, that is forgiveness and, you know, let's get on and work together as a nation. And that's really important. You know, that's a very strong gesture to the people. And we just hope it's not just, you know, as the words said, promises can disappear with Yothu Yindi's song that you just played, like writing in the sand. So that's why we need to have this commitment enshrined.
One of the other, I guess, proposals that's been put forward is that the government itself would sort of have the power to say yes or no and decide what to do with any discussions that come out from that Indigenous voice to Parliament. What are your thoughts coming from a First Nations perspective on the government choosing to still have control over that voice to Parliament?
It's going to be a decision, as Linda Burney and those leaders are saying, majority of Aboriginal representation that are already in government, it's going to be a decision of the people what that looks like. And if they're genuine in proposing that the consultation will take place with we the people, those that don't have the opportunity to sit, you know, in those seats of decision-making, then, you know, so be it. But the people will decide, as the people decided who our new government is today, you know, and don't underestimate the power of the people. My thoughts around, I guess, the greater inclusion would be, what does it look like for Australian South Sea Islanders who are a nation within the First Nations people? A nation of people represented through, you know, slavery and have that evident kinship with our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Yes, we have people with dual and tricultural heritage that are a part of this government Makarrata peace treaty voice to government. But at the same time, we need to flesh out, you know, the specifics of that demographic. And really, you know, if we are taking everyone with us, what does that look like for those families, you know?
Do you want Australian South Sea Islanders to be included in that Indigenous voice to Parliament?
Again, it's a conversation that needs to be put. Look, I'm in a position where I have advocated for many, many years to be heard on the shoulders of many that have gone before us in continuing the recognition, you know, fight, but for inclusion in programs, policies, services. But it's still, you know, I'm banging a drum. Many of me that are in the communities across Australia are doing the same thing, but we're not getting traction. We're getting lip service, we're getting recognition, which we're grateful for, but it's not enshrined in anything that, you know, I mean, Queensland's moving forward. We're moving forward slowly, but how long does it take? You know, it's on par. This year's 175 years since the first 60-odd thousand were brought here. Sydney was the epicentre for a Pacific slave trade. Burns Phillip, Robert Towns lived here. He's a, you know, entrepreneur, Benjamin Boyd. You know, they made their wealth and their political lives off the backs of Pacific labour. And still today, it's happening with our seasonal workers in holding up this economy. But at the same time, you know, the underdogs are being forgotten or bypassed. And that's the Australian South Sea Islander communities and, of course, First Nations communities. So how do we bring that together? How do we bring that to light and stand in solidarity, you know, and be heard together as a collective? I mean, I'm asking that question firmly, and will encourage people to have that discussion. We have to have the discussion. You can't leave anyone behind.
Yeah, like you say, a lot of dialogue and discussion still to come with many First Nations groups and the Australian government and the Australian people. What do you want to see in the next direct steps coming out of this Garma Festival? You know, there's been a little bit of discussion now. There's still, I guess, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has at first said that he wasn't going to release any details about what it might look like. Now he's saying he will release some details. What are you hoping to see in the direct next steps moving forward?
I just hope to see, you know, leadership from our First Nations representatives in that parliament that are going to drive this forward and to encourage the Australian people to have trust and just know that, you know, we're in the driver's seat now, so please just allow people to lead. You've got good people that have spent many years in activism, that have represented communities on the smell of an oily rag, and now they've been awarded that opportunity to continue to lead and bring this home for the people. And the people will decide. I mean, we can talk a lot about this, but we just need to get on with the business. It's been too long now.
Well,
so many have for us.
Imelda Davis, thank you so much for joining me here on Pacific Beat. And yes, we'll wait to see what those next steps will be and I guess who will be included in that discussion moving forward. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, great to speak to you. Take care.
That was Imelda Davis, Chair of Australia's South Sea Islander community in Port Jackson. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. And at the airport in Samoa, celebrations are underway.
It's our first time back since COVID, so it's been about 3 years. So it's great to be back. My bag's going to be empty when we go back.
Samoa has followed in the footsteps of other Pacific nations in opening its borders this week after 2 years of isolation. According to the World Health Organization, Samoa has had more than 15,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases and 29 deaths. This week, though, Samoan Australians have started arriving on the first flights into the country. And as Dubravka Volida reports, many others are also looking into booking tickets as soon as they can.
Samoan mother of three, Dora Onesemo, from Western Sydney has not seen her own mother and her six-year-old son since borders shut more than 2 years ago. She's looking forward to spending time with them soon.
You know, we've all been missing our family back home, especially myself, because I have my eldest son back home and my mom. I haven't seen in over 2 years. So, yeah, it's excellent news and exciting news, because now we can travel again or make plans to travel to see family.
She's in the process of booking flights for later in the year and says the past 2 years of not seeing them has been difficult.
For me, or as a mom, you know, it's quite emotional most of the time and quite stressful at sometimes when you're, you know, wanting to go see him or wanting to go see my mom or for him to travel here as well. It's been a really hard couple of years not seeing him physically and being able to hug.
Like Miss Onesimo, many other Samoans living in the diaspora in Australia, New Zealand and the US are getting ready to visit their loved ones. They will have to be fully vaccinated and show a negative COVID test before they arrive there. Should they test positive, they will have to isolate for 7 days. Also looking forward to welcoming visitors is the country's tourism sector. Before the pandemic, tourism contributed to about a quarter of the country's GDP, but with borders closed, the industry came to a near standstill. But that's about to change.
Every single one of the passengers and crew member will be presented with our fresh flower ula. With some more culture performances of entertainment, siga or dances, as well as songs, the music's all over around the airport.
Tutuila Farao is the Samoa Tourism Authority spokesperson.
Not every high-end and not every hotels and resorts and beach valleys are open at this stage because, you know, it will take a while for all the resorts, especially the high-end hotels, to recover.
One of the hotels open to visitors is the Taumisina Island Resort. Its manager, Tuitanga Nathan Bucknell, says they have been open through the pandemic and are ready to welcome overseas guests.
I think from memory, Samoa was the first kind of in the Pacific to shut down the borders, and we're kind of almost the last to open them. So it's been really good, and it's been very well received by hotels of the industry and by Samoans at home because they can finally visit their family and friends as well. Bookings are picking up slowly. I mean, I've been tracking bookings since the border announcement was made, and each week they're picking up. It's a little bit slower than what we would like.
Frank Liu from Samoa's Sheraton Aggie Grays and Sheraton Beach Resort has also been busy with preparations. While the former hotel is closed for renovations, the latter is open.
The 80% at our sister hotel, Sheraton Beach Resort, for August. Occupancy will stay about 80% towards the end of November or December.
Finding workers, however, is a challenge. Many tourism workers left the industry during the pandemic, and it's now biting the sector.
Yeah, staffing definitely is still a challenge for us, and given the 40% of workforce all have gone to, seasonal workers. But in seeing that, and I think if the opportunity is right, you are still able to capture talent here locally.
But Mr. Farao says they are well into recruiting and training new staff.
Very much a challenge for all the resorts as well as the high-end hotels. But Samoa Tourism has been, even with borders closed, we have been providing a lot of trainings for all our employees.
For visitors such as Dora Onesimo, her reunion with her family will be a long overdue, but most certainly a happy one.
Time with my son, time with my mom, time with family, because I have siblings back home as well. So I think just time spending with them, getting to hug them.
Dora Onesimo ending that report from Dubravka Volodar. For decades, the Morning Star flag has come to represent the West Papuan push for independence from Indonesia. And this week, a seminar in Canberra will focus on the international efforts to bring attention to the human rights abuses and violence taking place in the region, which has led to a displacement of tens of thousands of people. Benny Wender is a West Papuan independence leader and chairman of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua. And speaking to the ABC's Beverly O'Connor, he says their fight for independence has been overshadowed by other issues facing the Pacific region.
Yeah, this is from Cold War. This China and then America, and this is in the regions. It's like elephant in the room. Issue of West Papua always, buried under the carpet, and they look at the, interests of the, investment and trade and the security issue, but West Papua issue is never go away in the eye of the Pacific leader, particularly Australia and New Zealand, because West Papua look up to the, Australia and New Zealand because they are regional power. And, that's why it's important. And we know that security issue interest of the Australia and New Zealand, but also West Papua is, we are the gatekeeper in the regions, and so this is a moral obligation to see the big power in the region, what happening in the situation in West Papua. We know that Australia and New Zealand and in the region look at the what happened in Europe. We are sympathy with the Ukrainian struggle and, some happening. But West Papua is, struggle and fight is 50 years suffering under the Indonesian colony, almost 500,000 Indonesia massacre my people. This is genocide happening just 250 kilometers north of Queensland, its close neighbor. Mm.
There have been recent reports of intensifying violence, also claims of human rights abuses. Have things been worse than usual in recent times?
Yes, this is the United Nations have produced serial report what happened, what going on in West Papua. Since Indonesia deployed 25,000 troops in West Papua last 5 years, almost 450 been killed, and 160,000 to 100,000 are displaced. Place called Intan Jaya and Duga, Puncak Jaya, Maibarat in Oksibil near the Papua New Guinea border. 200 people have fled in the other side of the border. This is happening. This is happening. Current situation is becoming worse and worse. Indonesia reluctant to allow international media journalists to visit in the region since Indonesia illegally occupied. So that's why I always, my claim is Indonesia committed genocide. That's why they don't want the world to know what happened, what's going on.
You know, you had been hopeful at the Pacific Island Leaders Forum that this issue would be raised and that there could have been an independent party visiting the region. Were you disappointed that this wasn't put on the agenda?
Yeah, this is the PIF leader. We're already concerned current situation. And in fact, that 2019... they adopt the resolution supported by Vanuatu and New Zealand and all the leaders in the region. This issue is still there, but because of number of issues, let's say the China and also US and also climate issue, that's why leader didn't put the agenda. I hope that coming year will be discussed again, because this is a call of the Pacific Island Forum to call UN High Commissioner visit West Papua.
Yeah. The Indonesian President Joko Widodo will step down in 2024. Well, his term ends in 2024. What impact might that have for the fight for independence?
I think, yes, every president, new president, old president are same, but for us is the fight for the justice and freedom for, this is our fundamental right to, fight for, the, just like other people are fighting for their self-determination, like Kanaki people, Eflenkayas and us. Our struggle, we continue. Even the president changed, But our struggle still continues.
Yeah. You know, there's a new government here in Australia. Do you hope... What do you hope from that the new government in terms of aiding your battle?
I want Australia to work alongside with the Pacific Island Forum Corps because they are one of previous governments, previous government already... you know, join the call, UNI Commission Fishery. So I hope the new government to continue to call that because this is called from Pacific Island Forum, a resolution. So I hope they continue to support because this issue is very important.
That was Chairman of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua, Benny Wender, speaking there. Now, a jellyfish spotted in deep waters off Papua New Guinea has scientists excited about the possibility it could be the discovery of a new species. Experts are examining photographs of the unusual jellyfish to determine whether it's an unknown variety or a rare type last seen on the Great Barrier Reef. Dr. Lisa Ann Gershwin is a jellyfish expert from the Australian Marine Stinger Advisory Service and spoke with the ABC's Joe O'Brien.
Look, it was amazing. You know, so it was sent to me through the Jellyfish app. It's a smartphone app that some colleagues and I created. And it came to my email and I took one look at this thing and I went, oh, my God, look at this thing. It's huge. It's got to be highly venomous. And right away, I wondered, is it the same as the one that we saw in the 90s? We only saw one specimen in the 90s from the Great Barrier Reef, or is it actually new to science? And so right away, I became fascinated, you know, what is this thing? And, you know, I've since analyzed it very, very thoroughly, frame by frame, gone back, looked at the original specimen from the 90s. And yeah, I'm confident that it's actually a new species. So I couldn't be more excited or more tickled. And even Tui's excited.
And so, yeah, it's the extraordinary pictures of it. It just looks amazing. Tell us about the size of it and also why you say it would obviously be venomous.
Yeah, so as far as its size, it's absolutely huge compared to the one from the 90s. So the one from the 90s was about the size of the palm of your hand. This one's about the size of a soccer ball. So it's considerably more huge. It's also got a lot of differences, both external and internal, that make it different from the one from the Great Barrier Reef, the one from the 90s. You know, its size, its tentacles, its coloration, it's got internal characters. It's just got so many differences. And so in really comparing this one from Papua New Guinea and the one from the 90s from the Great Barrier Reef, yeah, I've come to the conclusion that, wow, it's new to science. So how exciting is that?
And tell us about the coloration in this new one.
Yeah, it's really spectacular. So the one from the Great Barrier Reef in the 90s has spots rather than rings. And this one has rings rather than spots. Hey, come on. And that wouldn't be enough to describe it as a new species, but it's certainly enough to make me wonder what's going on with that. And I actually suspect that's some kind of warning coloration, which is common in nature.
Right.
And I think it's basically its way of saying, hey, I am so toxic, I double dare you to touch me, you know?
And where to from here for you with this now?
Yeah, so we're just finishing up the manuscript to name it and classify it as a new species. That'll be submitted for peer review, just like any other paper. And then it's official. So it's really exciting. And, you know, the people that found it, it's actually a man, Dorian Borchards, who runs a scuba diving business in Papua New Guinea, and he was out diving and photographing with a customer for business, and they saw this. They saw six of them, believe it or not, and, you know, he's like, oh, my God, look at that thing, and they were these huge things swimming towards them, and they were like, oh, my God. So they got brilliant footage of it, and, you know, how lucky are we that we've got this so well documented.
And who gets to choose the new name if it is a new species?
Oh, look, definitely Dorian. It's his baby. It's his baby.
It sounds like a cool name as well. And so have you mentioned they saw six of them on that trip. Have they? I think that was back in December. Do you know if they've seen them again?
No, that's what's so interesting. So Dorian's been working there for more than 20 years and dives all the time, obviously, and he's never seen it before. And as far as we know, nobody else has ever seen it either. I'm human. I totally want to go there and explore around, see if I can find more of these things. I mean, I reckon people are going to be flocking to this place to see if they can find it because it's just so spectacular.
Jellyfish expert Dr. Lisa Ann Gershwin speaking there about jellyfish that have been spotted in the waters off Papua New Guinea that potentially could be this discovery of a new species. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat for this morning. We, of course, have our afternoon show at 3 p.m. PNG time. Tomorrow, Richard Hewitt will join you for the sports-focused show at 6 a.m. PNG time. And then next week, you have Priyanka Srinivasan back. Thank you so much for your company. Stay tuned, though, here to ABC Radio Australia.